We take advantage of databases that are built by powers much greater than ourselves. It's estimated that the average American has 26 records maintained on them by the time that they're 25. Everything from credit records, motor vehicle, driver's license, passport, social security, marketing databases, voter registration, or what have you. Most of these are databases that have a legitimate reason to exist, and most of those databases are publicly accessible. And frankly, I think that's the way it should be. If you are hiring someone or associating with someone or have a need to know about someone, you should be able to find out that information.
Do you think hackers make good private eyes?
The ones I work with do.
What do you think of the hacker community in general? Do you think hackers are a threat to privacy, or can we enhance privacy? Or?
I think hackers are essentially interested in the same thing that private investigators and public investigators are interested in, which is democratization of information, keeping information open and accessible and usable by the masses. As far as a threat of some sort, I think that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I think the word hacker is probably almost as overused as the word internet.
Okay, I'd like to point out, if people want to ask questions in the audience, they can line up by the microphone, which is in the center of the room, where that person is flailing their arms. Well, look who's there. Look who's the first question. Welcome to Beyond Hope, Rebel.
Guess who the first person is?
Let me just point out to everybody here and people listening who don't usually listen to the show at this time, this guy for the last maybe 5 years has more times than not always managed to be the first phone caller. I don't know how he does it. We've taken to picking up random lines, trying to get somebody else as the first caller, but he always manages to be the first caller.
Wait, before he actually talks, can I do my Rebel impersonation?
Yes. You okay with you, Rebel?
Is that all right?
Yes. Yeah, okay.
Hi, Emmanuel.
Well, Rebel, you have to say hi, Emmanuel, now, too, so we can
help. Hi, Emmanuel.
What do you think? It's not bad. Okay, what's your question?
Well, before my question, little sales pitch for 2600 and off the hook.
Remember, it's not a commercial station.
No,
you can't mention prices.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
There is off the hook CDs for sale. Have you
listened to those? You're on most of them, you know.
Yes, I know that. They're CD-ROMs.
We want to sell them.
Yeah, we're going to sell them.
All right.
And I like that thing, by the way, that computer. Put that computer thing on again. That attack thing.
Do you have a question?
About the...
Radio time is valuable.
Yeah. Now I'm forgetting what I was going to say. It was about the thing about hackers and...
Next caller.
I can't
hang up on me now.
I can't push a button.
No. My question is this. I noticed that these days there's a lot of things about, you know, bombings and terrorists. The Bernie S. case with the dental putty and the paranoia of the media, not the media, of the government in this day and age, because of things like the Trade Center bombing and the bombing of the federal building, and more recently the conspiracy to bomb in New York City. I guess the federal government is being, I wouldn't put it over paranoid, because yeah, they're going a little too far with arresting people and putting, you know, making more bail for hackers and people who don't do anything more than, you know, play with a computer than drug dealers or terrorists or something. And I think that that's a point that really needs to be addressed to the federal government, and they really need to understand things.
The answer to your question is yes. Thank you.
Let's take our next listener phone call.
Another question, please.
By the way, I'll be speaking...
another question from a different person. Rebel will be demonstrating some things later on, maybe at the open mic session, which will be
about after this.
At 8:30.
At the open mic session at about 8:30, I'll be doing it. Me and Bernie S. will be doing some phone demonstrations.
Okay.
And I'll be doing some different things.
Next
caller, please. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Grab the microphone from his hand. Yeah, okay.
Security.
There, no. Go ahead.
Love that man down.
Hi there. First, I would like to ask, is there a WBAI affiliate in Buffalo that you know of?
Well, okay, WBAI is part of the Pacifica network. There are five Pacifica-owned stations, Berkeley, Los Angeles, Houston, Washington, D.C., and New York. There are other stations throughout the country that carry some Pacifica programs. Off the Hook is only aired in New York, but we've managed to get the show out on Real Audio through our website and now through CD-ROMs. If you want a station in your area to carry Pacifica programming, you have to tell them, and you have to make your voice heard. And I hope that by making these do you have a lizard on your shirt?
It's Sea Frag's iguana.
Is it iguana? Okay. I just noticed. I figured you should know that.
Oh, I did.
Okay.
Also wanted to...
It threw me off. Now, the thing is, through the Real Audio, we've managed to show people what a station like WBAI can do. And I'm hoping that stations like BAI pop up all over the country, because there's just... When I drive in my car anywhere, there's always this big gap between New York and, I guess, San Francisco, where there's really nothing on the radio. And I'd like to change that, you know? I'd like to help change that in some way. And
very
you guys
pursuit.
Can help, too.
Civilize the Midwest.
Another question. This is Uzi. I want to set a civic siege in Buffalo. I really hope you're listening. Next caller, please. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, boy.
Emmanuel. Hey, I know I've talked to you about this before. And something I discovered while working on a voicemail. It's called the Amos Protocol. I wonder if Bernie or Fiverr maybe heard about this. It's really cool. What it does is it allows two voicemail boxes that from different companies to talk to each other. And I think it's audio messaging interchange specification. It's going to be replaced by VPIM, which is voice protocol for internet mail. But
Excuse me. You didn't just say Amos protocol, did you?
Oh, no. That would be the Amos protocol.
Maybe we should spell that out.
Amis.
Okay.
It's really not talked about much, but I went to EMA.org, and they're like this telecommunications standard.
If I could just translate this a little bit. Basically, a voicemail system calls out to another voicemail system, and they know that they're not just talking to each other without listening. They both know their voicemail systems, and they speak in some kind of special
language. Correct. I know to initialize, they use extended DTMF. I think it's the C key tells it that it's using Amos, and the D is sent by the second voicemail to say, okay, we know that you're using Amos. There's two versions, too. There's analog and digital. And I got the specifications somewhere, but I'm surprised somebody hasn't talked about this before, because it could be pretty fun.
Have you guys heard of this?
I never heard of it. I think I would have remembered that.
I think I'd read about 6 or 7 years ago some of the voicemail equipment providers were trying to establish some kind of interoperability between their systems, but they were all fighting amongst themselves as to who would make the standards. And Octel Communications, who manufactures the Aspen system, which a lot of regional Bell operating companies use for their answer call service, seemed to be leading the way as far as standards go. But then that got shot down by some other equipment and system providers. So, I think it's a good idea. You know, somebody sent you a voicemail from, and they were calling from a system where they had voicemail. It would, systems would be able to talk to each other, and it would make things a little bit easier. But I don't think it's going to happen.
It's being used. The Octel VMX has it built in. I know a couple of PC voicemails have it built in. So it actually is, it is being used. I got the specifications from someone at an unnamed
There's one thing
PBS.
We can do. We can call voicemail systems and hit the C key and see what happens.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. As long as you have to enable it in the configuration. But, VMX, that's a quick hack.
Well, it's something we'll look into now that we know that it exists.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the question. Let's give a hand to Veggie and Mike Rodancer for being on the panel. In a couple of minutes, we're going to start the media panel, which actually sort of got pushed into Off the Hook. And that's basically where we have a bunch of media people who actually are pretty cool. So we can't really attack them with the venom that we were reserving for CBS and ABC and those people. These guys kind of understand what's going on as far as media coverage of hackers. But it's a chance for you, the hackers, to ask them questions. And we'll be getting to that in just a couple of minutes. Now, Fiber, you've got something here you want to mention.
Yeah, I actually have a shout-out for PG Media. PG Media is a company who is challenging the Internet in and their monopoly on domain name registration. If anyone in the audience or anyone listening to this show has ever registered a domain on the Internet in the United States, they've had to deal with the Internet and the Internet's way of doing things. Well, PG Media is trying to do away with the Internet and challenging them directly. And their service is called Namespace or Name.Space. And the president of Name.Space is here, and he's actually handing out these petitions, which I think everyone should sign, anyone who agrees that in no way, shape, or form should a company, Network Solutions, which is actually made up of a bunch of former CIA and NSA employees, these people should not be in charge of registering domain names for all the United States.
I believe that things will be changing next year. Did you hear about this? There are going to be many different network solution equivalents, and they'll be having all kinds of top-level domains made available, I think, as early as March.
Yeah, I've heard something to that effect, but I've also heard that the companies need to go through some sort of stringent approval process.
You have to make a filing fee. I think it's about $10,000. Yeah, that's what it is, $10,000. That's dead? Okay, that's dead. Well, it's not easy, from what I understand. I think you have to have full-time employees. Is that dead, too? Why don't you step up to the microphone?
Yeah, get on the mic.
This is the guy, by the way.
Thanks. Hi, Paul Guerin here from Namespace PG Media. I want to thank Emmanuel and Fiverr for giving me the opportunity to bring this on the show. Just a very quick update on what's happening. Back in March, my company, PG Media, sent a letter to Network Solutions Incorporated requesting that they add the, at the time, around 360 new top-level names that were suggested by the public, international public, to the Root Zone file so they would be globally recognized on the Internet. Well, Network Solutions refused, and by their refusal, had actually broken the antitrust laws of the United States, because under the antitrust laws of the United States, that Root Zone file, the directory of directories of domains on the Internet, is an essential facility. So, well, we filed the case in federal court, and it is now pending in the courts. We are going full blast and seeking an injunction that the court order Network Solutions to comply with our request to add the now over 400 top-level domains to the Root Zone file, which will then enable other companies also to compete on an equal footing with Network Solutions. To enable this, my company and our development team has designed and coded a program called IDSD, spelled IDSD. That's an acronym for the Integral Database Synchronizer Daemon. And what that does is it decentralizes the top-level namespace, or the ability to register names, to any registries, and it makes dynamic updates on demand. Anytime a name is registered, the name registration update database is instantly updated and the names are available. This system will also, aside from opening it up to competition for local registries internationally, will also, number one, drop the price. We're currently charging $10 now to register your name in Namespace. But in addition to that, it will also eliminate the single point of failure, which caused the blackout on the Internet a couple of weeks ago when some incompetents at Network Solutions uploaded empty databases to CommonNet, causing millions of bounced emails and dead ends. And the reason that happened, for those who don't know, is that every night the Root Zone servers are updated with a complete brute force update. So if there's any corruption in those databases, it will just basically black out the net because they screw up the whole thing. With the ISDE system, the database is updated on demand, line by line, as it occurs, so it's always up to date, and this kind of catastrophic failure won't happen. So please go to the internet, namespace.xs2.net, and hit the link, and you can submit the petition to the Department of Commerce, who's soliciting public comments. If you don't agree with our petition, we also have a blank form. You can write what you like and also submit that. And the deadline for submissions is August 18th, so we have just about 9 days left. Please act quickly and tell your friends. And thanks for your time. Thanks a lot.
Okay, at this point, I want to thank Steve Rombaum for being here. Steve, do you have any parting words for us as far as how we can protect our privacy or where the hacking world should go from here? I said, okay. Well, thanks very much for being here. Let's give Steve a hand. Thank you. I want to welcome our media people now, get them on stage. We're going to take some more questions as well. But we have a lot of media people here, so we want to put them all on stage, and they're going to have to introduce themselves because I've lost track. I've lost track of who they are. Just all come on board and take your seats. And I guess we can take a question while they're settling in. Go ahead.
Bernie and Fiber, your story has moved a lot of people, and a lot of those people are here. A lot of them couldn't afford to be here or couldn't arrange to be here. Bernie, especially for you, has anyone approached you about writing up the story? And the media folks can comment too. Writing up the story into a possible screenplay format?
I'm sorry, I heard part of your question. I'm sorry.
Okay. Essentially what I'm saying is your story is a whole lot more engaging and moving than the net or a number of technology-based screenplays that we've seen. Has anyone approached you about bringing your story to the screen?
Not to the screen. A couple of people said that they were considering or thought it would be a very good. A couple of publishers told me it'd be a good book idea. I don't want to write the book because it would, it would not look very objective if I wrote it myself. And writing a book is a humongous project that just takes over your life for a couple of years, which I had my life already taken over for a couple of years. Really thinking about the case, looking back over it, a lot of it's very painful, just reliving all that by reading over things. It's empowering in some way. Like the other day I was reading over a lot of the newsgroup postings that Emmanuel had set up this newsgroup during my incarceration. Reading over that stuff, I was really touched by all the support people were lending. And still, though, looking back at it all, it would be really tough for me to try to encourage anybody to write that, because I really don't want to relive this whole thing over again. It really sucked. So no one's approached me for a screenplay or if whether I wanted to participate in writing a book. If anybody wants to write a book, knock yourself out. I'll give them all the materials from my case, and I'll answer any questions they might have. But it reaches a point where you just become emotionally drained dealing with the case, and you just want to get on with your life. So, and besides if Hollywood did anything with it, they'd probably screw it up like they do with every other movie that they try to cover a real event. So, to answer your question, no, nobody's approached me about a movie. In books, people said it was a good idea, but that's about as far as it went.
Okay, I'd like for our press people who are now on stage to introduce themselves. Let's start over here and go down and tell us who you are and where you're from.
Hi, my name is Michael. I'm with Paper Tiger Television, which is a nonprofit video collective here in New York.
Hi, my name is Jamie McClellan. I'm a producer with Paper Tiger Television as well, and I also work for an organization called Libraries for the Future.
My name's Lou Cook. I do occasional columns for Brock Meeks' CyberWire Dispatch, and I've been freelance writing since 1972, and before that, investigative reporting for NBC News.
My name is Noah Robichon. I created the Netly News.
My name is Rika Kasahara. I work for Japanese media. I have a column in PC Computing in Japan and also contributing writer for Wired Japan.
Yeah, hi, I'm Rob Bernstein. I work with Ziff Davis and formerly with Internet Underground, which unfortunately is defunct now. But
That's the first question I'd like to ask. What happened to Internet Underground?
It was Internet Underground.
Such a cool magazine.
Thanks. Thank you. I'm glad to see some people are reading it.
Yeah, but it's no more. It's gone out of business.
It's no more. I guess it, I got to be politic here. I like my job. I guess it comes down to bottom line profitability and, the hacking group's a small group of people. And as far as, with publishing, it's paper's expensive. And hopefully we'll get this information out there in one form or another in the future, though.
Now, Rob, you got into the hacking world as a newbie, pretty much, with the Bernie S. case.
Mm-hmm.
You reported a story about him, and before you knew it, you were right in the thick of the story yourself, and you were getting him into even more trouble just by doing things that you didn't think were anything important. Tell us briefly what happened.
Wow. I don't know if it really happened that way. But what happened was that Bernie and I worked closely together on this story, and I actually saw the story on your site, and I took a real interest in it, and it kind of fascinated me. And, reporters are always looking for good stories, and I think among hackers, they're only lawyers and politicians are held in lower esteem. But I wanted to do a good job with it, and I wanted to get in touch with Bernie and get his point of view. And so it really meant getting in contact with his lawyers and having him call me collect, because in prison, really, there you don't have any rights. And he had to contact me, which he did. And we had many great conversations. And, in the process, I really got to know Bernie and find out about his case. And I think we got to the point, and there were other people I interviewed as well, Tom Varney and other of the Secret Service and various other people who were involved in the case. I really wanted to hear everyone's point of view. But by the end of the story, I really want to make sure that the facts are all right, and I wanted to get Bernie the story. And I think Bernie also wanted the story, and we wanted to make sure that we did this right if we were going to do it at all. And, unfortunate facts for me got to Bernie. We both agreed that he needed to get the story, and upon his receiving the facts, unfortunately, there's no due process in prison. And they don't take kindly to any kind of communication with prisoners whatsoever.
From the media, that is.
Especially the media. And, they got very unhappy. And eventually they said it wasn't the facts that caused Bernie more trouble. I think that, Bernie, you'll have to step in. I don't know exactly what it was they ended up accusing you of. But I think the facts really prompted a lot of the trouble that you had in prison at that point.
Yeah, I want to first clarify or dispel any rumor that Rob in any way did anything to get me into trouble, either wittingly or unwittingly. He sent me a fax, and I don't think he thought anything was wrong with that. I was, at the time, I'd gone through, I think, three maximum security prisons, and finally, after my parole date had already come and gone and hadn't been interviewed, I was transferred briefly to a minimum security facility, and told that in exchange for being in the minimum security facility, I'd have to do community service, which wasn't part of my sentence at all, but this was the institution, Bucks County Prison in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, that said, well, it's voluntary community service, and if you don't want to volunteer, you'll go back to maximum security. So I was out on the chain gang pulling stumps out of the side of the road, that sort of thing, at a local county conservancy, where there was an office that I'd be in part of the day to clean up, wash, that sort of thing. There was a fax in the office. I told Rob where I was doing this kind of work, and we both agreed that I needed to read the final draft or next to final draft of the story, and I saw nothing really wrong with that, and it certainly wasn't against any of the rules in the prison handbook. So three independent people in your office were able to call and get the fax number at that?
Yeah, I mean, the fax number, it wasn't any mystery to the public. We had three people kind of call up, and we all got the fax number to where Bernie was working, and we want to get this information in his hands.
So the fax was sent, and before I knew it, I was in shackles and handcuffs, again, back in maximum security, with a new charge, an internal prison charge for violating one of the rules, which was, there's all these rules in the prison handbook, and one of them is you will not, when doing community service work while a prisoner, you will not use a telephone to contact friends or family members. Well, there was no allegation that I had used a telephone or even touched a telephone. A fax was sent to me, and that really bent them out of shape. They thought it should fall under that rule. I challenged that. My point was that I was not guilty of that. And I was not allowed to bring the only witness in, who was the secretary at the office, who saw that I did not use a telephone to contact anybody there. And I was not permitted to allow that secretary to be a witness, which was a violation of my due process rights.
So basically, receiving a fax while you're in prison can get you in a world of trouble, something we didn't know beforehand, and something I guess most people wouldn't even consider to be something bad or a crime of any sort.
And it went downhill from there.
Now, I'd like to ask any of the other people on the panel if they had any perceptions of hackers that they'd like to share, any myths they've encountered, tried to dispel, and then we'll take some more questions. Anyone?
Well, I think I come to this late, and I come to this with a lot of gray hair, but I also come with this with a little perspective, and that's the troubling part. Is that I see what is happening and how the media stereotypes and characterizes the hacker community is very much like what happened decades ago to students for a democratic society during the 1960s, and how they were demonized as commies and the people who were going to turn over the country to the North Vietnamese. I saw the same thing happen to the civil rights movement and how they were charged with being communists. And in the late 60s and 70s, some of this became a disaster because students were shot down and murdered at Kent State, and Black Panthers were murdered. And the problem is when you start demonizing, as I see the mass media doing to hackers, It builds in a possible permission for government to start extending the boundaries of what they can and what they can't do. And that, for me, is the most troubling element of the distortion, is where it might end. It ended very badly for the student protesters in the 60s. It ended very badly for the Panthers. I'm hoping that it doesn't wind up the same way for the hacker community.
Yeah, I really like that analogy. I think you also have to consider, too, you know, who the media is in this country, at least the mainstream media, and they're, by and large corporations. So who is most afraid of hackers? You know, by and large corporations, unless you happen to be working for them. So it seems natural that the media would criminalize hacking, you know, or would want to see hacking, you know, become more of a criminalized activity, not only to protect themselves, but as he said, to really create a public perception that hackers have nothing, you know, useful to offer society, so that legislation can be enacted as stricter. I think we've seen that happen.
Well, just let me differ one thing. I see the media as basically being lazy. And so they don't really take the time to understand. And so stories are fed to them by the authorities, by the FBI, by the Justice Department, that Kevin Mitnick is going to start World War III. And when you've got the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, Jamie Gorelick, calling for a Manhattan Project to combat hackers, I mean, what are you going to nuke the hackers? Are we going to nuke Kevin Mitnick? I mean, that's the kind of exaggeration that, in a sense, the media doesn't take the time to challenge. Say, is Kevin Mitnick going to start World War III? I don't think so.
And furthermore, on top of it, I don't think this is something that's going to change anytime soon. I don't think you're going to see... What I think you're going to see is an increasing corporatization of media and globalization of media. And the one message that I can offer from Paper Tiger Television to all hackers who feel like they're not represented well by the mainstream media, it's a motto that Paper Tiger Television has. It says, don't just watch TV, make it. And one of the means by which Paper Tiger is able to get our words out is through cable access television, which is, by law, something that the cable companies have to provide to the public. In Manhattan, we have four television stations that anyone
can provide their own television programming on free of charge on a first-come, first-served basis. On top of it, you can get trained for free on how to use the equipment, and you can have free editing time and free use of the studio at Manhattan Neighborhood Network. It's really very much in the spirit of WBAI radio, of making sure that everyone has access to produce their own media. And as a corollary in the telecommunications world, there's a provision, perhaps one of the only good things to come out of the Telecom Act of 1996, is the universal service provision. And the universal service provision ensures that everyone has access to telecommunication service. In particular, it says that public libraries and schools will be receiving between 20 and 90% discounts on all telecommunication service. This is their phone installation charge. This is even the internet access. This is even routers and hubs and Ethernet networking will be available for 20 to 90% off. But this is also cable refranchising and universal service that we have to constantly fight for to make sure that we maintain it. SBC is currently suing the FCC in order to stop universal service from happening. So it's something that we really have to be vigilant about.
Excellent points. I think we have to at some point stop complaining about the media and start becoming the media ourselves and starting to fix things in that way. And I think there's a very good example of that coming up on a panel here at 9 o'clock. Some folks on the Lower East Side are running a radio station called Steal This Radio. And I think they're doing a great job of showing us just what community radio is all about. You can find them at 88.7. Now, the thing about them is that the FCC hasn't said that they can be at 88.7. So they'll be answering some questions about that, about how they're running their operation. That's coming up at 9 o'clock. And you folks listening on the radio right now, well, you won't be able to hear that because we stop at 8:30, so you'll have to hightail it on down to the Puck Building if you want to see that panel. Cheshire Catalyst from Tap Magazine.
Hello.
What's all this about you getting back together?
About what?
You're getting back together.
Well, we are having a reunion of sorts this evening. One of the restaurants we used to meet in is Eddie's at 14 Waverly Place. And just a couple of us guys getting together over there, and it's the banquet room's been closed off already. So, you know, please, we can't have a big mob down there now. I was just in the back room starting to herd cats to get our little group up there in time for the 9 o'clock reception we're having up there. Just a bunch of the guys having some beer and burgers, seeing each other again, because I've been living in Florida for the last 10 years. I saw a couple of them 3 years ago at the first Hope Conference when all the hackers on planet Earth first got together. And I like to remind people when I tell them about Hope is hackers on planet Earth, not necessarily of planet Earth. So we're the people who do already have the reservations in for the CAP reunion, if they please meet out in the front foyer near the front door. After this, I'd appreciate it so we can start moving out.
So this reunion is obviously for people that were part of the TAP thing, which happened back in the 70s and 80s. If there are people listening on the radio that suddenly realize that they were part of that, they should come on down to Eddie's over on Waverly Place in New York City. It starts at 9 o'clock?
It starts at 9 o'clock, and they close the place down at 11. Tonight they might do it a little earlier, just, you know, because if we don't piss them off too badly, but we'll see what happens. It should be a good get-together. And it's good to see all those guys again.
It's good to see you again.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming by. Cheshire Catalyst from Tap Magazine. Okay, we can take some more questions now for our media panel. Go ahead.
This isn't exactly for the media panel, but I heard that one of the items encoded on a MetroCard's magnetic strip is the amount of money left on the card. And that would mean that when you swipe, not only is it reading, but it's also writing. I didn't think that was possible on a magnetic strip.
Well, that's actually one of the questions we asked in 1994 at the first Hope Conference. It appears that maybe they're using laser technology to do this. Again, that's going to be addressed tomorrow at noon, so any questions you have about that should be saved for that.
Okay.
Thank you. Next question?
Actually, can I respond to that right there?
Okay. Well, it'd be nice if somebody had a question for the media panel, but...
Sure.
Okay, I see somebody way in the back that does. Okay, go ahead. Give us your response.
Okay.
Us your response.
As far as I
Rebel,
can tell,
sit down. Sit down, Rebel. Go ahead.
As far as I can tell with the Metro cards, is I seem to think it's similar to the MO discs, where you have to put a heat on it before you can demagnetize it. You've tried using commercial demagnetizers and degaussing coils.
I have enough trouble just getting it to work in the first place by swiping it. So I haven't been experimenting with heating it up and doing all those kinds of things.
Haven't been able
but there
to
are
remove...
people that have been doing that. I'd like to hear from them.
Right. We haven't been able to remove information from the MetroCard, but one of the things we're going to try doing is adding a current through the strip and also heating it up to check its other properties.
Okay. We have a question for the media.
Yes, a very specific question for the
Go
media.
Go ahead.
I'm curious what the media thinks about the role of John Markoff in the Metnick case. Because in some ways, I think that what Markoff did, this is my opinion, was quite unethical as a journalist, getting involved in the case and actually setting up a situation that became more dangerous because he was trying to profit by selling a book and a Hollywood movie. What do you think about that?
Just to give people some background here, John Markoff had co-written a book called Cyberpunk with his now ex-wife, Katie Hefner. One of the chapters was about Kevin Mitnick. They never spoke to Kevin Mitnick. However, they wrote a third of a book about him. And then on July 4th of 1994, I believe, there was a front-page story about Kevin Mitnick being on the run, being a fugitive. It's kind of strange for that to be on the front page of the New York Times about a computer hacker that was on the run. Nevertheless, it was, and it made the whole Kevin Mitnick saga that much more public. Then in December, Tsutomu Shimomura's machine was broken into allegedly by Kevin Mitnick, and Tsutomu Shimomura happens to be a friend of John Markoff. John Markoff then helped Tsutomu Shimomura track down Kevin Mitnick. And the day that Kevin Mitnick was caught had another huge front page story and many, many stories after that. There's a lot of questions raised as to his participation in the trackdown of Kevin Mitnick. And shortly thereafter, let's say within a week, he signed a multi-$100,000 book deal for the Kevin Mitnick story. And to this day, he still has not said a word to Kevin Mitnick. So, yeah, I'd like to ask the media people what they think about that. Anybody?
I have to say that I think there are a lot of problems with that, and it's not just Markoff. I mean, Markoff, I don't think, is a particularly bad example. It's much worse in the industry. People are taking a lot of bribes in the way of equipment and information that, you know, they've agreed to write a story about that I think is a huge problem. And I think it's... has a lot to do with the corporatization of media, especially print media and TV, that says that you have to have a huge salary and that you have to back up your huge salary with certain kinds of stories and make it look that way, make it look like sensational, basically. And I think that's a lot of what Markoff was doing, which is unfortunate. But I would also say that this is a hugely empowering time where you can fight against that, that we have a chance to let the Internet not grow up to be like radio and television, where you don't have that control or where you have to fight for public access channels, as we do in Manhattan, but where you are able to, you know, you're able to print anything you want and people will actually read it, amazingly enough. So I would encourage you all to start writing, start reporting.
Speaking of Kevin Mitnick, tomorrow we will have Kevin Mitnick's lawyer telling us the latest on his case and the things that have happened over the years. Kevin's been in prison now for 2.5 years. He has not yet even gone to trial. I'd like to ask Rika, you know, from the Japanese media, and I'd like to know what the Japanese culture is with regards to hackers, what kind of reaction they have towards hackers, how are things different there?
Almost exactly like United States a couple of years ago, and especially in Japan, there are the two kinds of people can exist: either contributing member to the society or criminal. Therefore, hackers are criminal. So, computer literate people, engineers, trying to change that image by quoting Stephen Levy and Richard Stallman, and they are trying to define hackers and crackers in different ways. that's what's happening right now. And I published a book which I wrote about Bernie only in the first article in Japan. And I got a lot of hate mail saying, Bernie's not Hakka, he's Cracker. So I am going to start like a discussion group in English. And if you, any of you want to participate and exchange information or teach them what's actually going on in the United States, kind of appreciate that.
I'm actually curious if any, you mentioned criminals in Japan. I'm actually curious if any organized crime rings like Yakuza have become more technologically oriented.
You are totally right.
Yeah.
Japanese hackers or the crackers, whatever, started from doing prepaid phone cards because they used to have up to $300. So it's a big major money. Now they have $10. And then Yakuza find out, ooh, it makes lots of money. So give me the equipment. Otherwise, we're going to pull out a bunch of guys and attack you. That's what's happening. And so now that prepaid card, phone card is sort of Yakuza's island to fight over.
Okay, do we have a question? Is that microphone on?
Actually, that's a great segue into my question for her, because I've personally been to Japan and I can vouch for the fact that it's the ultimate hack with access-friendly payphones and ISDN ports on almost all the payphones that I saw there.
Yeah, right.
The primary method of payment, however, is the prepaid phone card, and I had the opportunity to talk to some people who could have been considered hackers there. They were a little reluctant, to say the least, to divulge any information to me about their methods or how they actually got away with free, you know, calling, free long distance, etc. And it seemed to me that there was a definite fear of NTT, which is Nippon Telephone Telegraph, sort of the equivalent of AT&T here. And when he mentioned organized crime, I almost said that would be NTT, because talking to these guys, it sounded like the prosecution from NTT could be very harsh. I know we've had stories here about what happens to Americans. I also have a second part to that question. There was an American in 1996 who got busted in Japan for accessing and doing that same thing, fraudulently creating prepaid phone cards. Could you tell us what happened to him, if you know?
Is that the three people with the French guy in there?
There may have been a French person. The only thing I actually remember was an American. He was probably in his 20s, and he was a tourist there and decided to start a lucrative career for himself, prepaid phone cards.
No, I don't know what happened, because I've been in San Francisco last 8 years, but they definitely made the news, and that was very big news back in Japan, because no one back then thought about doing it in Japan, and they said it was so easy.
The problem is it's an American, and that you know, sets a bad taste in people's mouths there for how hacking got started in Japan, but... Do you know what actually happens when somebody gets busted, what NTT does or the government there?
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
Do you want to give the, should we give the telephone one more try? Let's see if there's any nice people out there. Number is 212-343-8268 for our listeners if they want to call in, especially from...
Oh, there it is. Oh, they're out there, aren't they? Let's hear that ring one more time. I love this.
Yeah.
Okay, let's hope this is an intelligent person.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering what happened to Bernie S. Like, totally, overall?
You want to hear the entire Bernie S. story? Well, the entire Bernie S. story is part of the prisoner panel tomorrow. It's an extremely detailed... Oh, yeah, I disconnected that person. Extremely detailed account of living hell for the last 2 years. And if you want to hear the full story, come to the prisoner panel tomorrow, and we'll be getting into that in some detail, as well as Fiber's story. Let's take one more phone call and go to some more questions. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
How you doing?
Yeah, I'm interested in finding internet service provider that's cheaper than direct PC.
Can we hear this guy? Can you, we bring him up? You can't hear what he's saying. I hear what he's saying, but you can't.
Hello?
Why is that? What changed?
Hello?
Can you repeat your question?
Yeah, I'm interested in satellite internet service providers, and I'm looking for a cheap one.
He's looking for a cheap internet provider.
a cheap satellite internet service provider.
A cheap what?
Using a satellite technology.
Is anybody here use DirectPC? Is it any good? Getting a lot of blank stares. I think maybe we're not ready for this question yet, technologically. Bernie, do you have any suggestion on that?
I was looking into it recently, but it's they charge a fairly high price. They sell it in blocks of minutes, your access. It's a 400 kilobits per second download. And there's a lot of latency. I don't know what it, maybe you know what that is, fiber.
Things are changing. I mean, there's new technology being developed almost every day. ADSL technology, fiber, maybe you could say something about that. That's supposedly going to be the next high-speed way of connecting two things, that and cable modems. Anybody here have a cable modem? Nobody? Okay. Are you happy with it? Not really. Okay. Barbara, you have anything to say about ADSL? What's that?
ADSL is a new technology. It actually stands for Asymmetric Digital Subscriber Line. And it's actually going to be the thing that's going to be obsolete by the time we get it, just like ISDN, because that's usually how 9X does things. But anyway, ADSL is going to be far above and beyond the speed of ISDN presently. And in the places that are already offering ADSL, which are pretty scarce, we really don't know what we're missing, because nobody here, and I don't know if anybody in this room actually has, a good... I don't know if they're actually going to roll out 6 megabit lines at first, but I think we're really being cut short with our ISDN that we think is really so great. It's really not, especially provided the fact that ISDN technology has been around since the mid-80s. And ADSL isn't exactly new, and we still don't have it yet. But we will.
And the company that will bring it to you is AT&T, yes. Okay, question for the media. Go ahead.
Actually, I have a question. The gentleman from PG Media brought up the topic of a single point of failure with Internet. And I was wondering if he knew, or if any of you knew, to what extent they took security measures and had potentially redundancy built into this top-level database of domain names, so that there isn't a tremendous failure if that machine gets hacked. Do you have any information on that?
Yeah, the problem with that is in root-servers.net, you have A, B, C, D, E, F, G. You have over a dozen machines that serve as the root name servers. And the good part of that is that if A goes down, you have all the rest that could kick in and take over. The problem in this particular circumstance is that A was not down. A was up and running, except it was advertising garbage to the rest of the Internet. When you actually try to connect to a site on the net that isn't currently being cached by your own local DNS server, you're basically your DNS server is going to go to the root server, whichever one answers first, which is usually A, and it's going to ask that root server who are the authoritative DNS servers that carry the zone maps for the particular site that you're trying to connect to. And as you well know from the whole media incident, that machine was responding with garbage in most cases, which all the local name servers all over the place were caching, and in essence you weren't able to really reach anywhere. So how do we guard against something like that, which is human error, and how do we guard against people hacking the root name servers? Well, we really can't, because as things stand, even in the latest version of Bind, Paul Vixie's Bind, which is 8.1.1, there is a mechanism in it to support DNS, domain name service authentication, but it's not currently used, because the only way it could possibly work is if everyone used it, and everyone is not using it. And the other problem is that there's really no reason to hack the root name servers, because it's already too easy to spoof DNS in general. And there's plenty of resources on the internet and all the security mailing lists that talk about how to do things like that. It's a relatively simple-minded protocol as it stands today.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but
it looks a little puzzled.
If a malicious hacker decided that they wanted to try to force the system into failure by taking down machines, there are a set of redundant servers so that would be really difficult to do?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
If one of them went down, there are over a dozen that could take over.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we're winding down. We're listening to a special edition of Off the Hook on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. We're on the air every Tuesday night from 8 to 9 p.m. on this radio station, not in front of 500 people, though. A couple of things that I'd like to share with people in these final minutes. First of all, did you know today is Senator Jim Exon's birthday? Did you know that? Well, we all know who Senator Exon is. But, you know, we thought that could actually be used to our advantage. You see, we tried to do something really, really cool for this conference. You've seen the Beyond Hope stickers everywhere, right? You've seen the Beyond Hope signs. You see the Beyond Hope flag outside and the banners. Well, we thought, wouldn't it be really cool if we could get the Empire State Building to light blue and white for the hackers of America and the world? So we called them and we said, hey, you know, you guys lit up for Microsoft and Disney and all those people. Do you think you'd do this for hackers? And they said, no, we don't do things like that anymore. We only light up for, you know, for special occasions, national holidays, things like that. So we said, I don't suppose you're going to light up for Senator Jim Exon's birthday, will you? Blue and white are his favorite colors, after all. And, they wouldn't do that either. So we set about looking for a country whose national holiday falls on August 9th, which is today. We even bought an almanac to look this up. And after going through all the countries, we found the country whose national holiday is today, Singapore. That's when I knew there was a God, because if there was ever a perfect country, it's that country where, I mean, technology reigns supreme and fascist minds control everything and you can't chew gum and all those crazy rules they have over there. So we figured, okay, great, you know, it's Singapore's national holiday. Let's tell the Empire State Building to light up, you know, the Empire State Building blue and white for Singapore. The only trouble was Singapore's national colors aren't blue and white. They're like red and gold or something. So we were in a quandary trying to figure out what are we going to do, you know. Then suddenly we realized, hey, we're dealing with Singapore here, you know, revisionism central. Let's revise their history a little bit. So we just made their national colors blue and white, formed a little company called the Singapore Cultural Center. We even got a phone and an address. In fact, if you call information, look up the Singapore Cultural Center, you'll get us. Then we connected to their website, got all kinds of information out of them, and finally came up with a reason to make our colors blue and white. Blue for the blue-collar workers, white for the white-collar workers. We're all joined together in harmony and bliss. So light the damn building for us. It's our day of independence. And we asked them to do that, and we called them. We made up several Singaporean names. But in the end, they said, well, we just don't have the capability of doing it anyway. So the whole thing doesn't matter. Unless somebody was able to, you know, to backdoor the system and light the building, I think it's just going to be white again tonight, which is, I guess, their salute to white power or something. I don't know. But anyone over there listening that has access to the Empire State Building's lights, you know, blue and white is our color. Be nice to see that. We tried. It was kind of fun. We wasted a bit of time. Okay, we're in the last couple of minutes. I just want to give our panelists a chance to say something. We have an open mic session coming up in about 5 minutes, and I see Rebel standing there, so he's going to be the first person on open mic, and that'll be coming up in about 5 or 6 minutes. Hi, I see you. You're waving at me. Yes, I can see you. So in about 6 minutes, you'll have a chance to say what it is you want to say. Any last words from our panelists?
Yeah, I just want to say a quick thing if I can. If for people in New York City who are, you know, interested in fighting back against big media, there is a new group called the New York Free Media Alliance, and there's a voicemail, and it's 212-969-8636. So if you're interested in working with independent media folks, you know, turn out.
Yeah, I would encourage you to do that as well. And if you're interested in working, if you're interested in working on cable refranchising and universal service, you might want to check out Access for All, which is a local coalition here in New York that works on those issues. You can reach us on the web at www.accessforall.org, all one word.
Well, for me, this is my first hackers convention, and I've got to tell you, the fact is that you are the best and the brightest, and that is the pleasure for a reporter like me. It's the pleasure I've had in working with Brock, and this will not be my last one. So thank you all for your insights.
I understand that somebody hacked the Netly News homepage, so I'd like to write about it. So if you could please come find me, I'd really like to know about it.
Have we been hacked yet? Has anyone hacked us? No? Well, come on. You only have a day left.
So, I would like to start mailing this with the American hackers and the Japanese hackers or the people who define it, or wannabes, whatever, can exchange their opinion and information. So, if you're interested in helping me or participating in it, please drop me a line, rika@will.com. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I just want to thank everyone for reading Internet Underground. If you have any complaints that it's no longer a newsstand, feel free to contact Ziff Davis. I'm sure they'd be more than glad to hear from you guys. And please come up to me afterward if you guys have any interesting stories, kind of like Bernie S. I'd be happy to get your story out there.
Okay, coming up after the open mic session at 8:30 p.m., at 9 o'clock we're going to have Steal This Radio, the folks who are doing radio down on the Lower East Side. They'll be explaining what they're doing, how you can get involved, and maybe bring this knowledge back to your hometown. 10 o'clock, we have Ira Winkler giving a talk on where hackers and criminals collide. And at 11, Fiber and Tom from England will be giving a talk on GSM phones and their security and privacy issues. I want to thank everybody for being a part of the radio show tonight. Thank the panelists, Bernie S., Fiber. I want to also thank Veggie for stopping in, Mike Rodancer, Steve Rombaum, and Cyber Junkie, and of course, Major Hacking. Thank you very much for coming by. I thank all of you for listening, for being in the audience, and of course, the good folks back at WBAI. We'll be back again on Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Till then, this is Emmanuel Goldstein for Off the Hook. Have a good night.
And this is back to WBAI New York. Next up will be, what is the name?
The Underground Railroad.
Underground Railroad, and you can find the webpage at hiphopmusic.com. Now we're going to have a message. Oh, and by the way, Off the Hook, the next broadcast will be in 71 and a half hours, 8 p.m. on Tuesday, every Tuesday. And now we have a message about Monday morning, and we're on to Real Radio.
WBAI-FM. Listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
Spot, find the radio station. The world's monitoring the broadcast.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. The man has spoken.
Who are you?
I'm all mixed up.